ways, I am living in two different worlds, and it's hard for me to pin them down. And I don't mean just, there's the church world and then there's the secular world. That's one way of looking at it. But it's far more profound and subtle than that. The best way is to understand it is the way I introduce myself in two different contexts. Let's say I'm in professional circles, academic circles. Let's go say I go to a party of some friends of mine who are basically professional people. Okay, then I get myself a beer and I introduce myself to, there's a new group of people that don't know me. I come as an anonymous person. How do I present myself and what happens? Okay. Now, the normal way of doing it in Australia is to say, look, put your hand up and say, hi, I'm John Kynick. Okay, and then the person will say, I'm Bill Brown or whatever. Now, if I go to a party, or if I'm in academic circles or professional circles, the next question that people will ask is, well, John, what do you do? What do you do? The assumption there is very profound and very modern and very recent in human history, is that your being, not just your identity, but your being, who you are, is determined by what you do, your performance. And that's determined by your position in society and by the paid employment that you have. Now, I'm running into difficulty because how do I answer that question? I'm a retired what? A retired human being? Retired pastor, retired lecturer, theologian, nobody knows what a theologian is, nobody knows what a pastor is except in church circles. So I'd say I'm a retired priest. And that gets me in a heap of trouble because they suspect them that I'm a child molester or something. Yes.
I don't know if your microphone is on. You could just check it.
Thank you. Yes. That's better. So, what you do determines what you are. Now, that's a very recent way of us understanding ourselves and causes us immense problems, and I don't want to analyze that, but you want to do it yourself. If you're wanting to see the trouble that look, what troubles your people, this is one of the issues. That view of being, that view of identity, performance, achievement, etc. You know, well, your whole society is built around that. However, if I go to Lutheran circles, let's say I go to the Brossa Valley, which grows the best wines in the world, at least the best Shirazes, where I grew up, and I say, hello, I'm John Kleinig. Do you know what the question is?
Where are you from?
Yeah, where? No, usually
who's
that's
your
the
father?
Second question.
Who's
Who
your father?
Was your father? Who was your father? Are you that lot? Where are you from? Are you that lot of Kleinigs? So the question is of father, ancestry, and location. Not location in society in terms of occupation, but physical location. So, I'm Kleinig, yes, and I belong to that group of Kleinigs, and my father was born there, and I come from this particular part of the Brossa Valley. Okay, then once I am people have that, they know how to relate to me, they accept me, the door's open. But until they find some genealogy and some point of contact in genealogy, it's hard for them to sum me up. Now, what's the assumption that lies between that traditional view of human beings? And this is very, very difficult for people who come from outside Lutheran circles. Now, who's your father? Okay, it's Bill Brown. Okay, that's not a Lutheran name. Then they ask, who's your mother? Oh, she's Elmer Segenschnitter. Okay, yeah. That's right. Okay, now, this annoys the living daylights out of my wife, who, whose background is not Lutheran and Eastern European. But there's a profound reality behind it. What's the basic assumption? Is that who you are is determined by where you come from, or in both senses, the place you come from, but more importantly, the people you come from your father and your mother. Your identity is not constructed by you. Your being is not, you don't create your own being, but it's given to you by your people and your place, your location. And so in any traditional society, you get genealogies that are very, very important. Have you noticed all the genealogies all over the Old Testament? Now, it's only Americans and Australians that are not terribly interested in genealogies. Wherever you go in Africa and Asia, genealogies are the most important thing. We had a bit of a chat about this, didn't we? Or was it with somebody else that I chat in Africa? What we have here is two different approaches to understanding who you are and your approach to history that comes out of it. On the one hand, you have the modern approach to history. When I studied history at high school and university, is this on?
No.
I switched it off again. Yeah, okay. When I studied history, being at university, we looked at it in two ways. The basic way was in terms of cause and effects. Now, this is a very modern one. So, what were the causes of the First World War? That kind of thing. What were the effects of the gold rush on Australian society? Okay, so cause and effect, basically. And then you have the future, the purpose thing. What was the purpose of federation in Australia? That's the second view, which is you have, the idea is that you have a particular goal. You plan, you have a goal, and then you try to implement it more. Well, and then the question is, how successful were you in implementing your goals? Now, church growth is all about this. And that view of history, which is manipulatory, by the way, and very, very, it does great damage to human beings and to congregations. But that's the modern approach. You can work out that further. I'm not interested in that, but I'm interested in the traditional approach to the past. And that's exemplified in genealogies. Now, what does a genealogy do? It tells you who your father and your grandfather is, or grandmother. And very often, they include then place references. Who are your ancestors? Where did they come from? So, a typical Australian Lutheran genealogy is, who's your father, grandfather? And then you skip generations to the first Kleinig that came to Australia. And I guess the same is in some Lutheran circles here. If you can trace your way back to the Stefan group, well, that puts you in the historical elite, or the historical rogues, as the case may be. The question is who the relationship between past and present is the relationship between father and son, or mother and child. So can I simplify? The idea is, it's not just cause and effect, but who you are is determined, your being is determined by your parents, your ancestry. You're a chip off the old block. And if you want to understand, me, you've got to know my parents. And so in the Barossa Valley, people say, oh, he's a typical Kleinig. Or he's a going mother's side. Oh, yes. Doesn't he just look like a Pech or a Wurst or other parts of my genealogy? Okay, chip off the block. Father, son. Now, That's still the way it is in many parts of the world. So, for example, Abraham is the father of Israel. Okay? He is not only the ancestor of Israel, but he embodies Israel. And who he is, he determines what Israel is. So every descendant of Abraham shares his key characteristics. And it goes all the way to the New Testament, where Abraham is the father of faith. And the father of faith. If you take the basic question that people ask about any institution is, what is the father of this? So who or what is the father of wisdom in Israel?
Solomon.
Who is the father of praise singing psalms?
David.
Who is the father of the temple in Jerusalem?
Aaron, Solomon.
Okay, that's more ambiguous, isn't it? It's, you could go Moses, but more accurately it's David and Solomon. But Solomon, he's the temple builder. Who is the father of prophecy in Israel? No, that's not the question. There's only one tradition, but that's not the dominant answer. Who is the father of the law, the Torah?
Moses.
Who is the father of the divine service?
Moses.
Well, maybe Aaron. You know, it depends on where you want to put the emphasis. Samuel. I know Samuel is the father of, and hence he comes first in the prophets. But he's also priest, not strictly speaking, because he doesn't have the priestly genealogy. Did you have your hand up?
No.
Okay, so the relationship between past and present is father-son. Or another analogy is foundation building. Now, this is one that's very important, foundation building. We have the idea that we leave the past behind us. But in fact, we either build or don't build on the past. We either build appropriately on the past or we build inappropriately on the past and away from the past. So the foundation of a building, lies in the past, it was laid, but it's the ongoing basis for the building. So the foundation is the ongoing basis for the building as it is. If the building falls into disrepair, then you rebuild it but on the old foundations. So the relationship between past and present is foundation and building. You find that metaphor all the way through scripture. Foundation, building. Or another one is the relationship between as the seed and the plant. Now, there is development in history, but good development is not complete new innovation, but it is the unfolding of what was there in the beginning. And not the unfolding of bad characteristics, but unfolding of the good characteristics that are there. By the way, I find this a very helpful analogy in pastoral care. One of the problems that all of us face is the problem of ritual abuse, abusing people spiritually by imposing ourselves, our story, our ideas on them, instead of helping them to build on what God has given them in themselves, and to help them to unpack and unfold that. Okay. Now, going to this ancient view of history, now that helps us understand what the book of Exodus as a foundational story. The whole of the Bible has to do with God's foundational acts, particularly the Pentateuch is the foundational document of Israel. It sounds as if I switched this off again. No, it's still on. But Exodus, I would maintain, is one of the foundational documents of Israel. Now, the basic assumption here is that God provides the natural, religious, social, and political order for his people and for all people by his word through the first things, the Rishonoth. You have a magazine here in America, First Things, do you know it? Great general magazine, which comes from 1 Corinthians, where Paul says, I hand on to you as first the things that were given to me. But it is the first things. It doesn't just mean the first in time, but the foundational things. So there are foundational things. So Isaiah 1:26 says, I will restore her, that Zion, Jerusalem, I will restore her judges as at the foundation of Zion, I will, and her counselors as at the beginning. So it's back to the beginning, back to the foundations. It's not turning history backwards, which you can never do, but rebuilding on the old foundations of Zion, Jerusalem. So lying behind, just something, if I could touch on this notion of order. I don't think that we will meet the challenge that faces us in the new context that we have in the West and across the whole global situation, in what people call postmodernism, unless we begin to recapture and appreciate the central insight of the ecological movement. Now, what drives, there's a number of drivers in the ecological movement, but the key thing is that the relationship between order and chaos, or to put it in ancient terms, cosmos and chaos. I took a confirmation class last year, which is very interesting. I hadn't done that for yonks. 11 kids, and most of them had very little and fairly nominal contact with the church. And in talking to them, I asked them one of the questions, what did they fear most of all? As young teenagers, but if I had time, I'd go through all the various options. But what they feared most of all, you could all put it in the category of chaos that had come from their parents separating, divorcing, the chaos that had come to them because their mother or father had remarried, the chaos that they faced at school with bullying, sexting. All that terrible stuff that young people face, the chaos that they face at Facebook, the chaos that they face by fear of insanity. They all knew a number of their friends that had gone, had problems with mental sickness, depression, chaos. And worst of all, they all knew somebody who committed suicide. And they all feared for the future, ecological. If there's one thing that's been drummed into young people, is that we are facing an eco catastrophe. Do you know what that does to a young person, their soul? When they looked at the world politically, they don't realise that in fact we have greater peace now than we've had any time in history. But what do they see?
Chaos
politically. So wherever they look, they see chaos. Now, that's not a modern understanding. In fact, that's the old pagan picture. The old pagan picture is that basically the world is chaotic. And then it's the job of human beings, together with gods, to establish little pockets of cosmos. The picture that I like to use is, if you think of a jungle. Now, you have a jungle, and you clear the jungle to build a house and establish a garden. But you don't just do that once. In tropical areas, if you clear the jungle, establish the house, what do you have to keep on doing? You've got to clear the jungle almost every day, because unless you keep clearing it, it reverts to chaos. Now, even physics talks about the law of entropy, which is the reversion to chaos. And there's a whole new branch of physics, which is chaos theory and mathematics. That's another whole story. But the natural order is what? It's towards chaos, disorder. And what human beings fear most of all is disorder. And the greatest disorder is where you get collapse of whole societies, like, for example, in Rwanda, in Africa. Or you had, say, the social political collapse in China during the Cultural Revolution. That's about as bad as it gets for human beings. Now, okay, you have the basic order of things is chaos, and you've got to work flat out to establish a little safe area, a secure place for yourself, a refuge, a safe place. Now, have you noticed how important that expression is for many people, a safe place? Safe place that you can trust, where you can just be, and you can be safe, because the basic thing is fear and being under attack. What God does, I can't go into all of this, but the Old Testament tells a different story. It said that when God created, it's not so much interested in how God created the world, but what kind of a world God created. What was it? Ordered world. Look at Genesis 1. It's not a story about the technique that God created it. It's not even the chronological sequence, basically, but it is the order God created, and the fact that God ordered the whole of his created world. And in the Old Testament story, therefore, chaos is not part of the order of the world, but it comes as a result of human sin. So God, now, to lead up to what I'm coming to, the basic understanding of the Old Testament is that God, through his word, creates order. He creates ecological order, to use the modern term, in creation, Genesis 1. He even creates order in a fallen world by giving human beings permission to use the sword for capital punishment. Now that's order in a chaotic situation. He establishes order in natural order, he establishes order in human history, fallen human history, and government comes out of that. He establishes social order right at the beginning, because he didn't just create human beings as individuals, but he created marriage. He created Adam and Eve, and he instituted, and this is the important word, he instituted marriage as an order. And out of marriage then comes family. So he institutes natural order, family order, which is basically social order. He institutes political order. And most importantly, he establishes religious or ritual or liturgical order. And you were talking about that, because ever since the fall, what's the sad story of human beings when it comes to worship? They don't worship the real God, but they worship idols. And what lies behind idols?
Our own fear.
Satan and demons. No, it's satanic. Not directly, but that's what lies behind it. So, establishing holy order. And God does establish his order through his word at all levels. We have wonderful resources in this that needs to be reappropriated to deal with the new sets of questions that we face. Luther's teaching of the three divinely instituted holy orders. Of what are they? Church, family, and society, or the government, which is the social order. Yes?
In Minnesota this fall, we have a ballot amendment allowing same-sex marriage.
Yes.
Now, could this be argued if if God's creation of marriage is order,
yes,
then anything in opposition to that, as a counterfeit, would be chaos.
That's right. And this is the way we need to deal with it. As I see it, we Christians have missed the boat with the whole homosexual same-sex marriage thing. But the whole sexual question is the big problem area, not just outside the church, inside the church. It also means that divorce is chaos. And it also means, before we start pointing at same-sex marriage and homosexuals, look at what's been happening in the heterosexual community. What's the norm? Living together. You face that almost every marriage you have. And then once people are married, the shocking figures is that of divorce. You'd expect big differences between Christians and non-Christians about divorce. Now, you can handle that moralistically, but I don't think you can present a compelling vision that will galvanize young people if you just wag your finger and lay down the law. But if you talk in terms of order and chaos, you're on their home page. Because those kids know from their own experience the chaos that comes at every level from broken families, divorced families. And we haven't begun to see the beginning of that, the effects that are going to be working through our social systems, the chaos that's been unleashed here. Order chaos. I would put to you that that's a key category in evangelizing, re-evangelizing the lost generation or lost generations in the West. It's interesting that when I, for my generation, and I'm 70, and I think it would also be Stephen's, going down to Stephen's generation. How old are you?
56.
56, going down to about there. The buzzword for us and our generation, particularly the hippies, was what? What? You said?
Baby boomers.
The baby boomers, yeah. What's the one? Yeah, it's peace. No, the more important for peace for
freedom.
Them was freedom. That's the freedom generation. Now, that's what galvanized us. And we carried across into the church and the freedom of the gospel, which meant that we got rid of the law, everything. So freedom. Freedom then becoming license. Now, if I start talking in any seminary class that I have, if I start talking in a waxy eloquent about Christian freedom, do you know what the reaction is? Order. Disinterest, basically. Why? Because they've had freedom up to their
and it led
necks
to,
and over.
It led to chaos.
Hmm?
And it led to chaos.
It led to chaos. And they're faced with far too much freedom. And they've seen that freedom leads to chaos. And that's their growing identification, that freedom leads to chaos. But then on the other hand, as soon as I start talking about order, and God, not just order, because that's a bit scary, but God's order and God's good order and God's good order for blessing and for a good life.
You're a legalist. Legalism.
Not with the guys below 30. With the baby boomers, yes. Okay? And I've had that said many times. But with young people below 30, at least the ones that I know, most of them, they sit up and alert. They want to know more because this is new to them and it's attractive to them. If I could just summarize that God basically establishes order for human life and for good human life here on earth through His Word. He establishes order within creation, ecological order, natural order. He establishes family order, social order. He establishes political order. He establishes religious order. And that order is for the benefit of human beings. And freedom and fulfillment only comes within order. That's where you have safety, security. That's where you can trust God. You see, if you have disorder, it leads to mistrust. Not just mistrust of human beings, your parents letting you down, friends letting you down, mistrust of society conning you, mistrust of teachers who sell your porky, but there's a mistrust, basically ontological mistrust, that you can't trust the world. You can't trust things. And so you've got to be on your guard everywhere at all times. God establishes good order for his creation, and he establishes good order in his church, and I want to focus on that, and God's establishment of order in worship. Now, this is where the rubber's going to hit the road. But let's go and do it before we talk about it.
Just one quick announcement before we